This morning, we'll have the pleasure to hear some reports of young scientists delivered at posters at the PAC meeting, at, as it was already announced in the reports of the PAC chairmen. I think that we start with a presentation. How robust is the third family of compact stars against pasta phase effects? Speaker Alexandre Ayrian from the Laboratory for Information Technology. Please.
Thank you. Good morning, dear members of the Scientific Council. It's my pleasure to give a talk today, and I'm grateful for PAC Advisory Committee for this opportunity. So this results has been obtained under support of Russian Science Foundation. This is a part of this grant, and this is our group and collaborators. Why it's so interesting to focus on this third family, so-called third family of compact stars, because third family create so-called twin stars, which are stars with the same masses but significantly different radii because of different structures. So one day if twin stars will be detected, it can immediately answer on a lot of interesting questions. At least some exotic stage of matter could be, has to be inside of compact star which is from third family, and another one from second family. So it's also this twin star supports also the so-called critical endpoint of the phase diagram, QCD phase diagram, because if we have a neutron stars leaves at the around zero temperature and very high densities at the phase diagram, and if we will have a strong phase transition in the matter at zero temperature, so it means that somewhere we have a critical endpoint, because here we know that it's crossover type phase transition. So third family is a solution of TOF equation. This Tolmo-Opinger-Volkoff equation is for used for calculation structure or configuration of compact stars based on equation of states, relation between pressure and density. And solution to this equation could be different, like it could be poor second family, so-called second family, poor hadronic branch. If we vary, yeah. So here we have an initial condition like a central density of the star, and if one vary this central density, he can obtain the mass radius relation for a particular star. So this is a star family with different central densities. So the blue one is a poor hadronic stars, and they could be phase transition in the matter. Then we have a hybrid stars which is connected to the hadronic one, but it's still second family because it is connected. But there could be like red and green solutions, branches, but there could be a branch which is disconnected from the poor hadronic branch. It's called third family because this part of branch where the mass goes down with increasing central density is unstable. So stars couldn't live here, but after some point, we have again some stable branch where stars could be. So it could be possible when we have a very quite strong phase, first order phase transition in the matter. So, and the idea of this work, question for this investigation was how such solution of a family robust against mixed phase in the phase at the phase transition, because mixed phase could be exist. I mean, could exist. And we have investigated the so-called pasta phase, where different structures of hadrons could appear inside matter and quarks, let's say. Such possible mixed phase called pasta phase, because it has pasta type structure. It could appear because of Coulomb interaction and surface tension, where Coulomb interaction would like to distribute like charged regions, but surface tension needs to hold it. So surface tension usually described by like a free parameter because it is unknown. And why it's called pasta phase, because it looks like very tasty Italian pasta. But the problem is that the calculation of pasta phase is quite complicated. One needs to go over all at the given density, go over all different structures and sizes to find a minimum of energy. But if pasta phase exists, it means that it has to be thermodynamically more preferable. It means that in pressure and baryon density relation, it has to go above poor hadronic and poor quark phases. So this fact is used to find a method for mimicking pasta phase, and we have suggested two methods, which is based on interpolation between some critical points here in hadron and quark matter, and some additional pressure at the critical pressure where phase transition happens. So the first method is based on just interpolation, simple interpolation, for example, parabolic or fourth order. And this additional pressure, of course, still remains like a free parameter. And this is results is obtained for multiple heliotrope equations, multiple approach to equation of state. And this is for different order, this interpolation for different order. One can see here speed of sound against chemical potential. And this is for parabolic interpolation. This is fourth order and sixth order. One can see here still have a very strong jump on speed of sound, which indicates first order phase transition. Here it is not jump, but it is still quite strong behavior, so it is still indication of first order phase transition. But if we will increase the order of this interpolation somewhere, it will go like crossover type phase transition. So the second method. This is additional pressure. This and this, yeah?
No, the right hand side, the upper and the lower. No, you are always on the left hand side, go to the other side.
Upper.
Right.
Upper left?
Справа.
This and this? Okay.
More or less, no
deviation. No, the difference is that it is not smooth. It's connected but not smooth, but this is smooth behavior. So, and the second method, it is so-called mixed interpolation, where, because the first is called replacement, because we just replace this part of around the phase transition by some interpolation. But this is mixing of hadron and quark matter. So because And they are just switching off function for hadron part and switching on for hadronic part, and this is for additional pressure, the function of additional pressure. So a bit more complicated formalism, but this is results of mixing and replacement interpolations. So mixed phase looks like this here. This is pressure against energy density, and this is speed of sound. And one can see for the mixing interpolation, we have such also peak here because it maybe it's more realistic because it shows some phase transition from hadronic to mixed phase and from mixed phase to quark one. So, and this is mass radius relation results or relation for that equations with mixed phase. One can see how mixed phase impact on the mass radius relation here. And somewhere for some relative additional pressure, the third family solution disappears. For the Bose methods, it's quite not it's approximately no difference between two methods. So, but it was for multi-polytrop approach. But what about some realistic equation of states? We have used two equation of states for hadron one and for quark matter, which is given in this articles. What is interesting that there is some parameter which is called, for example, for quark matter, the available volume fraction, which changes stiffness of quark matter and can and it allow to produce a different type of solution of tough equations. So we can also explain some low mass twins and high mass twins with this equation. So this is unreadable results. We combine these equations and we also vary the additional pressure on the mixed phase and this is the pressure against energy density and mass radius relation. One can see that we have here quite a low twin stars and high mass twin stars also. And this is some zoom of that results. One can see how it looks, how mixed phase looks like on pressure energy density relation, and this is mass radius relation. And we also obtained some additional pressure, relative additional pressure, 5-6%, where third family solution disappears. So, and now the question is how this additional pressure relates to surface station of the real pasta phase. So such calculation has been done, and one can see here this is dot. It's a real pasta calculations. It's done with collaboration with Yasutaki from Chiba Technical University, and with different surface tensions. And this magenta line, it's a feed by our model. This is for simple parabolic model. And one can see that feeds quite the model could explain the mixed phase or fit mixed phase quite good. And the interesting thing that for zero sigma, we have the highest possible additional pressure in the matter. So, and we have obtained it around 5-6%, which is exactly at the limit of the existence of third family. So one can conclude that for this models, third family solutions robust against the pasta phase. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions, remarks? Horst.
Yeah, normally what I see when I look into the word pasta phase, I think about the different nuclei which are in the outer crust.
Yeah.
So you just took this very well studied phenomenon and now put it onto the quark
hadron
matter transition. If I calculated this before, I would have probably gotten a competition with you. Good idea. But my question is now the following. How good are your two different branches which you relate by a switching function. We know Kapusta has done the switching function for mu equals zero matter, what Paolo Giubilino has studied many years at ALICE. And there I know how you do it. It's an old chemical concept. You take two functions and you make this transition with the lambda which you showed up the one, down the other one. It's not the same as the as a normal, regular first order phase transition. But now here the question is, what do you use in the quark phase? Is it just regular QCD or do you add vector repulsion between the quarks to be stable? Because with the normal QCD you always get too soft and you cannot reach, as far as I remember, you cannot reach two times solar masses because the system just collapses into a black hole.
So
how do you stabilize this quark core?
So quark about the quark matter model. So it's done with by Blaschke and Nils Ove Bastian from Wrocław University. This model based on some idea of it's some midfield approach. It's based on idea of possible available volume fraction inside which change stiffness. We also use number Yona Lazina model sometimes, but quark core in the compact star is a result of tough solution. So if it is not stable, we will not obtain stable configurations of compact star.
Thank you.
Some other questions? I don't see. Thank you. We move on to the next speaker, Yulia Harka. Fusion, fission, and quasi-fission in the near barrier reactions, sulfur 32 plus gold 197. Please.
Good morning. Thank you for the introduction and thank you for inviting me here to give this talk on the fusion, fission, and quasi-fission competition in the near barrier reaction of sulfur on gold. It is now well known that in collisions of massive heavy ions, the reaction may proceed through different mechanisms. And after the capture stage at near barrier energies, the denuclear system may reseparate before achieving a full equilibrated compound nucleus. This is now known as an out-of-equilibrium process which hinders the fusion towards the synthesis of heavy and super heavy elements. And it's still interesting to study what are the reasons why this is happening. The strength of each process usually depends on the entrance channel dynamics and entrance channel properties such as the form, the deformation of the system, the excitation energy, and the charge of the system. So we propose to study in the reaction between sulfur 32 and gold 197 by exploring the most common observables, such as the mass and the total kinetic energy of the fission-like fragments, and extend the correlations to gamma ray observables to get further insight on the processes which occur in this reaction. For the practical fulfillment of this experiment, we employed the double arm time of flight spectrometer Corset, which was composed of two arms, each composed of one microchannel plate start detector and a positive sensitive microchannel plate stop detector. Each arm was placed at approximately 66-68 degrees forward angle with respect to the beam axis. From the registered signals, we extract the parameters such as velocity vectors, energy, angles, mass of the fission-like fragment, and the time resolution, which is approximately 150 picoseconds, allows us to extract the mass resolution within a resolution of approximately 3 atomic mass units. Here are some details on the experimental conditions. As I mentioned, we extended the measurement to gamma ray observables connected to the fission-like fragments. For this purpose, we put the Corset spectrometer inside a dedicated reaction chamber at the Alto facility of IPN or SE. And at backward angles with respect to beam axis, we placed 10 germanium detectors, which were also shielded with BGO detectors for the Compton scattered gamma rays. And the first cluster of what will be the future Paris calorimeter to measure gamma rays, and one other single phos switch. Each phos switch was composed of a lanthanum bromide component and a sodium iodide component. While similar in photopeak efficiency, the detectors of Orgam excel in energy resolution, and the Paris detectors give us access to high energy gamma rays emitted by fission fragments. From the data measured with Corset, we obtain the mass energy distribution. Granted fusion occurs, this system of sulfur on gold will lead to the neutron deficient 229 americium, excited at around 43 MeV. As you can see, as expected from liquid drop model, the mass distribution seen here has a Gaussian-like shape, and compared to the prediction of the liquid drop model, is a little bit wider. The asymmetric component, which we extracted, represents approximately 9% of the fission events, and could be a suggestion of an out-of-equilibrium process, but the uncertainty is enhanced, since in such cases near the barrier energies, this could be also induced by, for example, the multimodality of compound nucleus fission, and could be a super long asymmetric compound nucleus fission. This asymmetric component is also confirmed in the average total kinetic energy per fragment, which is seen here, that for most asymmetric splits is higher than the liquid drop model prediction. So we have this component which is not easily pinpointed. I would like also to mention that the Corset spectrometer also gives us access to the velocity vectors of the two fission fragments, and this can help us in precisely correct the gamma ray energies for Doppler effects. I would like to briefly mention a few features of the gamma detectors. The Paris detectors have a very good time resolution, which allows a precise discrimination of the gamma rays against neutrons, which you can see here in this time-energy correlation of the registered signals in Paris. And in the case of Orgam, as I already mentioned, each German detector was had in implementation a BGO shield, which can help us in discriminating against the gamma rays which have left the German detector before for energy deposition. And it seems that around 30% of the gamma rays have left the detector. And we have checked the smooth running of the Corset and Orgam coincidence with the elastically scattered events. And you can see here that already, just by applying these appropriate time gates, we have diminished the background almost completely. We have first looked at the high energy component, which was measured in Paris in coincidence with the fission-like fragments. And we readily see that there is contribution of a high energy component, which has been suggested in the past on studies of spontaneous fission on californium, that this could be some hint at a super long fission channel. And while we gate on this high energy gamma rays in Paris, we can look at the fragments which have emitted these gamma rays and see that there is maybe a preference for this particular split of a closed shell effect in this heavy fragment, although it's hard to conclude given the very low statistics. Besides the besides this single gamma ray observables, we would like to look at the global observables, such as the gamma ray multiplicity connected with the fission fragments. And for this purpose, we have taken the fold of all detectors which fired in prompt coincidence with a fission event and translated it to the gamma multiplicity, taking into account the geometry and the efficiency of each detector separately. As you know, in a fission event, the gamma rays are emitted isotropically, and we don't have a method to conclude which gamma rays came from either fragment. And we propose to divide this gamma multiplicity according to mass, which is the most simple assumption, and you can see here with the black points the division of the gamma multiplicity per fission event according to mass, and compare it to other methods and models. A very well known method used in the past was to use a large collimated detector and try to measure only the gamma rays which came from one of the fission fragments. And for this purpose, I assumed that the Paris cluster is only one huge detector and related the hits to the to only one of the fission fragments. And this, the results are shown in blue. But it is readily seen that the random coincidences are lead to a higher gamma multiplicity per fragment. But we have compared our results also with two models, the general description of fission model and the Gemini++. Although Gemini yielded a higher gamma multiplicity, Gemini++ is in very good agreement with our results. Now that we have our gamma multiplicity, we would like to move forward and derive the fragment spin, the average total fragment spin. And it seems that we are still missing one ingredient, although we have the gamma multiplicity, and that's the... That's the neutron multiplicity. So to obtain this final ingredient, we propose to derive the excitation energy of fission fragments from our measure observables. And I used a simple method that's using the total kinetic energy, which we measured, and the Q value of the reaction, which I can obtain from the known mass defects of each fragment split. Then, after I obtained the excitation energy of the primary fragments, I divided between the two fragments proportional to mass, and obtained the average neutron multiplicity per fragment and per fission event. Again, our comparisons with the two models are in very good agreement. But there are still some uncertainties which here enter into play. For example, our spectrometer does not measure the charge of the fission fragments, and this is one of the assumptions I made. We cannot say specifically if there was or not emission of neutrons precession or from the descent from saddle to scission. That's why we think that we may confirm or infirm this neutron multiplicity from the signals measured in Paris, but now discriminating the neutrons registered in Paris against the gamma rays. And as a preliminary result, it seems, first of all, that correlation has the same shape as our derived neutron multiplicity from the excitation energy. But we need to further tune our calibration and efficiency calibration to get the exact magnitude of this neutron multiplicity. And then we will have all our ingredients to obtain the total spin of the fission fragments. And while we look at the correlations with mass and TKA, we are certain that we could see a different behavior for quasi fission process and the fusion fission process. So in conclusion, the three detector systems were successfully coupled in a first campaign at IPN ORSE while studying the near barrier heavy ion collision of 32 sulfur on gold 197. We obtained the mass and TKA correlations in very good resolution. And we see contribution of an asymmetric component, which we still try to pinpoint. It's where does it come from? And for this, we extended the measurements to gamma ray and neutrons. And ultimately, we hope to conclude on the spin inducement of in the fission-like fragments and clearly distinguish the contribution of the two mechanisms. Thank you for your attention, and I would like to thank our team and collaborators. Without their help, this work would not be possible.
Thank you. Questions? Faisal.
It's a great pleasure to see that a program that we pushed when I was director of ORSE is given very nice result. Can you just explain me a little bit, what is the high energy tail of the high energy gamma ray tail of the spectrum, and why is it correlated to this mass distribution?
Sorry?
Is it the dipole? Is this the soft dipole?
You mean here, yes? I just looked at this coincidence, and we don't want to exactly conclude, because you can see it's quite low statistics here, but from calculations it may be some collective resonance, maybe some pygmy dipole resonance, but it's still under discussion.
Interesting, thank you.
Yes. From one of the fragments, we may assume, because this prompt coincidence with the fragments is these gammas came from these fragments, so we don't know any nucleus in this mass range which could emit such a high gamma ray just from one single transition. So. I don't think so, because we went through a lot of procedures of retrieving this full energy in the four switches, and we added back all the scattered events in the cluster, so I doubt it.
Other questions? Marek?
To this spectrum. In fact, if you put the gate a little bit on the left side, what would be the mass distribution?
So, in principle, I did a few tests on right, left, and so on. It does change. Yes, yes. Especially while moving to the left, it's just a complete random mass distribution.
Other questions? If not, thank you.
Okay.
My name is Gleb Artem. I performed the presentation analysis of the walking ability of the planar graph and tunnel field effect transistor in the presence of the vacancies. Pure graphene can be used to create classical types of field effect transistors because of the pure graphene have no band gap. The presence of the band gap caused the main characteristic of transistors, the switching ability. The switching ability is the ability to switch from a case when current is flow, in the case when the current doesn't flow, and back. to create a band gap in graphene using additional techniques such as doping graphene with nitrogen atoms or using multilayer graphene. However, the additional techniques complicate the creation of graphene transistors and increase their cost. In BLTP was patented a model of the transistor based on pure graphene, which doesn't need to create a band gap. The device works due to the effect of tunneling from special electronic states on the edge of graphene. The use of pure graphene reduced the cost of transistor compared to transistors based on functionalized or multilayer graphene. The model of tunnel transistor considers the situation when graphene doesn't have the structural defects and the transistor works at the peak of operability. But this simulation doesn't consider the appearance of random defects in the experiment. Random defects like edge vacancies can arise in the graphene structure despite the controlled methods of the synthesis of graphene. The ideality of edge is important for tunnel transistor because it works due to electronic states on the edge of graphene. In the best case, random edge defects will not affect the performance of the device. In the worst case, completely damage it. To finally understand this issue, has analyzed the efficiency of the tunnel transistor with the edge vacancy defects. For the analysis, we used the tie binding methods and the green function methods. My presentation will consist of three parts. In the first section, I talk about how the tunnel transistor works and realize the switching ability. In the second, how vacancies affect the electronic states of graphene. In the third part, how the different concentration and distribution of vacancy affect on the performance of the device. Let's start. Tunnel field effect transistor based on graphene is a nanoelectronic device whose switching ability is based on the effect of tunneling of charge carriers. The transistor consists of the silicon gate and a layer of a silicon oxide on which lay the graphene sheets separated nanogap. Graphene sheets connected with gold contacts. Graphene sheets are rotated to each other by the zigzag edge. The edge type is not chosen by chance. The edge atoms of zigzag edge graphene have special localized state. The edge states are characterized by high electronic density of state near the Fermi level, providing the switching ability of the device. The edge states appear due to the forming non-trivial topological Zach phase. The topological nature of the edge states make them more stable to weak perturbation that to the operation of the device is more stable. The sheets are separated by a 0.45 nanometer wide nanogap. The nanogap wide has selected so that the charge carriers have a high probability of tunneling from graphene sheets to the another. If you take a smaller white, the sheets are connected to each other by covalent bonds into a single sheet of graphene. In this case, we will return to the fact that the sheet will need to use the additional techniques for the making of the transistor. If the nanogap white is larger, the probability of tunneling will decrease exponentially with increasing of distance. This will lead to a distance of about 1 nanometer, charge carriers will not tunnel in through nanogap. The width of the nanogap is the main barrier to the experimental creation of device. Over the past 10 years, progress in the field of graphene cutting has reduced the size of the gap at 20 times. In the experiment of the STM lithography, the maximum width of nanogap is equal to 5 nanometer. It's still a big gap for the tunnel transistor, but we hope that the trend will continue and appear more accurate ways of cutting graphene for the creation of the tunnel transistor. The main contribution to the operation of the device is made by the edge states. Let's take a look how the tunnel process occurs and how the edge states affect the switching ability of the transistor. The figure schematically shows the total density of state of the two contacts. The density of state is the number of energy states at each energy level in a certain energy range. The filled energy states are indicated by yellow squares, the empty states are white squares. The total density of state means that we show the average dose of all edge atoms. In the density of state, we see a high peak associated with the H states, but this peak is separated because of the mutual influence of contact to each other. The current doesn't flow at zero voltage because the free states are opposite the free states. In order for the current to flow in the system, it's necessary that there are free states opposite the field states. Let's apply the voltage to the contact. The applied bias voltage shields the density of state relative to each other, inducing the opening of the energy window. The energy window is the energy interval in which charge carriers tunnel from one contact to another that leads to the appearance of current in the transistor. For example, the electrons will tunnel from the energy window. The current is proportional to the number of charge carriers occupying the free states. We have three field states, but one a free state, so the current will be small in this energy range. Then, the electrons tunnel from one H state to another. Electrons are enough to occupy all the free opposite states. Therefore, the current will be large. In the latest energy range, the current will disappear because there are no more charge carriers that can tunnel. The highest value of the current will be in the region of tunneling from the H states to another H states. Turn on the gate voltage. This leads to the filling of the free states and a displacement of the energy window in the area with the low density of state. In this case, the current will be strongly suppressed due to the fact that tunneling takes place in the area with a small number of free states. Let's compare the schematic current curves. We see that the high peak associated with the H states falls when the gate is turned on. We see that the high peak associated with the H states, this is the range of voltage realized the switching ability of transistor. The more difference between this peak, the better the device works. Take a look at the calculated current voltage characteristic of the tunnel transistor. The black line is the current without a gate, red and blue with the gate voltage. The on-off ratio is the switching ability of the device, calculated at the ratio of the current without the gate and the current with the gate at the same voltage. In the figure, we see a high peak associated with the H states and the reduction of current in the energy area where the gate is turned on. We have considered the ideal working of the transistor, but we still don't know how defect can affect the H states. It's important because the stability of H states determines the stable work of the transistor. Let's place a single vacancy on the edge of graphene and number the nearest H atoms. We will compare the local density of states of atoms closest to the vacancy with the ideal case. In the figure, you see the two lines. Blue is the ideal local density of state. Orange, the local density of state under the influence of vacancy. The energy value has the dimension on the interaction parameter from the tie binding method, which is equal to the electron volts. For the first neighbor, it seems that the peak of the H states is reduced and the region with the low dose has increased. A similar picture we see for the second neighbor, with the difference that the peak of the H states is high again. For the third neighbor, sub-peaks are reduced in the area with the low dose. For the fourth, sub-peaks are completely disappear and the density is equal to the ideal case. Hence, we conclude the vacancy redistribute dose of three nearest neighbors. One vacancy will not affect the operation of the device, but we can assume that the interval of influence will overlap with the increasing of number of vacancies. Let's add one more vacancy and analyze how the density of state will change. The region of influence of the neighbor will overlap because we place the vacancies on the distance of four atoms. We calculate the local density of state of atom located between the vacancies. At the distance of four atoms, we observe deviation from the ideal case. Again, in the region with low dose appear sub-peaks, which arise due to the vacancy effect of the H atoms. In the next case, we see that the peak of the H states is reduced and the sub-peaks become more expressed. at the distance of two atoms, the H state is strongly suppressed. The highest of the subpeaks exceed the highest of the peak of the H states. In the latter case, the H states almost completely disappear. Therefore, the stability of the H states will be influenced by the location of vacancies relative to each other. Let's consider the effect of concentration in distribution of vacancies on the performance of the transistor in the final part. We saw the approaching of defect to each other leads to the reduce of H states. This is a local influence which doesn't affect on work of transistor, but at a bigger concentration of vacancy, the local effect can spread to all graphene edge. It will lead to redistribute the total density of state that can affect on the performance of the device. We know that the presence of the defects reduce the peak of H states and leads to the appearance of subpeaks associated with the vacancies. The applied gate voltage shifts the density of states in the region of H states. There will be low current due to the fact that the H states are suppressed by the influence of the vacancies. Applied gate voltage moves the energy window in the region of those containing subpeaks. Subpeaks appear the IV curve like additional peaks on current. This leads to degrading of the switching ability of device because the peak of H states is reduced. Depending on the location on the vacancies, the dose will vary in different ways. To modeling the appearing of random vacancies, we used a random number generator which placed vacancies at three distribution. First, the normal distribution with low dispersion. In this case, vacancies appear in the middle of the sheet. With increasing concentration, the array of vacancies grows to the edge. The influence of vacancies spread only at atoms nearest to the array of vacancy. The next distribution is a normal distribution with a high dispersion. This case had the same characteristic, but at high concentration appear the same the single vacancies closer to the edge. It leads to expand the range of redistribute the dose. In the case of uniform distribution, appears a large number of single located edge vacancies in different place of edge. The effect of vacancies has a maximum rate that may destroy the edge states. The calculated IV curve at concentration of defect 30, 50, and 70% show on the slide. For the normal distribution, increasing defect concentration causes a reduction of the peak associated with the H states and an increase at the height of number of subpeaks. The device is not damaged critically even at 70% concentration. For the normal distribution with high dispersion, the peaks are formed in a wider energy interval. The height of the main peak decreased and the subpeaks increased. Also, we see of the reduction the on-off ratio at high concentration. With the increasing concentration of defect, the device efficiency markedly deteriorates. For uniform distribution, the height of subpeaks is found to be greater than the main peak and at a low concentration of defects. The transistor stops functioning at the concentration higher than 30%. For all cases, concentration of defects more 70% also destroys the performance of the device. Summing up, affect the distribution of vacancy critically influenced to the height of the peak associated with the H states. So, tunnel field effect transistor have stability performance at 30% concentration of vacancies. This conclusion is important for the design of nanoelectronic device whose operation is based on the existing the H states in graphene and can help in the experimental realization of tunnel field effect transistor. This presentation is based on article effect of H vacancies on localized state in semi-infinity zigzag graphene sheet published in GTP letters and effect of H vacancies on performance of planar graphene tunnel field effect transistor published in Europhysics letters. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Artyom. Questions? Remarks? I don't see. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Well, now we have a festivity, which is the award of Ponte Corvo Prize to Professors Hoagly and Lisi, and Professor Matveev, accompanied by Alexander Olszewski, will do the formalities.
Dear colleagues, at its previous session, the Scientific Council approved the recommendations of the GNR International Jury, by the way, very high scientific jury, headed by Professor Alexander Olszewski, on the award of the Bruno Pontecorvo Prize to Professors Giuliano Luigi Fogli and Eligio Lisi from NFN Bari in Italy for their pioneering contributions to the development of the global analysis of neutrino oscillation data from the different experiments. It's my pleasure to welcome the laureates to present them in this zaal. They receive the diploma and present the talks also. Please. Diploma. By the decision of the Scientific GNR Council, by the Joint Institute for Nuclear Research, the 2017 Bruno Pontecorvo Prize is awarded to Professor Gianluigi Fogli, University of NFN, Bari, Italy. Please come. Может, мы здесь станем? And the 2017 Bruno Pontecorvo Prize awarded to Professor Eligio Lisi from
to hear the presentation of the two laureates. The first scientific presentation is by Professor Gianluigi Fogli. Please.
Friends, I have to say that I am a bit confused, and maybe you can understand the reason of that. After more than 50 years of research in physics, in particular in neutrino physics, is for me really beyond my imagination to receive this this prize. I am really happy and proud of this, and it is my intention to thank all of you, in particular the Scientific Council of the of the Joint Institute of Research of Nuclear Research, the director, Professor Matev, and the international jury which have assigned to me and to Eligio the prize. It is important for me to thank all the collaboration I have seen in my activity, and first of all I would like to thank Eligio Lisi, an extraordinary physicist. After a collaboration of more than 30 years, I can say that he is between the leaders in neutrino physics in the world. Together with Eligio, I would like to thank also the young people working with me and with Eligio in the so-called mythical Bari Group. And the Bari Group has made a lot of physics, I think a lot of good physics. And the merit must be ascribed to the young people working in it. I would like to thank also my wife, a great woman, for his encouraging, for her suggestion, for being always with me. And I would like to remember also Mila Baldo Ciolin, another great woman, a leader in neutrino physics. Her confidence has been very important to me. And now let me turn to my brief presentation. As you see, we are hunting the last mixing angle. This is a activity which means that we go back in time about 10 years ago in the 2008, and this is more than 50 years from the first mention of neutrino oscillation by Bruno Pontecorvo, but 10 years after the first evidence of neutrino oscillation in atmospheric neutrino. You know the well-known presentation of Kajita on behalf of the Supercamio-Kande collaboration in 1998. What is the status of neutrino mixing in 2008? Okay, a few years earlier, in the 2004, by combining solar and Cambria data, a unique, well-identified solution is found for the solar neutrino, the so-called large mixing angle solution. Solar neutrino oscillation have been successfully reproduced through long baseline reactor oscillation, and the solar neutrino problem has been solved. In a similar way, several experiments have been realized with the result of reproducing atmospheric neutrino oscillation in labs with a proper choice of neutrino beam energy and baseline. For example, you see here the K2K and Minos working in muon disappearance mode. In other words, we have large and well-measured oscillation effects. One set of oscillation parameters needed for large amplitude flavor transition of atmospheric and long baseline accelerator neutrinos, for example, Supercamio-Kande, they control the atmospheric neutrino oscillations and are characterized by well-defined frequency, related to the square of the mass difference, and to an amplitude which is related to the sine square of the mixing angle. In a similar way, we have another set of oscillation parameters for large amplitude favorable transition of solar and long baseline reactor neutrinos, for example, Kamlan. And also in this case, you have a well-defined frequency related to the other mass difference and an amplitude which is related to the sine square of the other mixing angle, theta 1, 2. Going to the Pontecorvo mixing, when parameterized in terms of the product of three matrices, you can distinguish here a larger rotation near to be maximal, characterized by sine squared theta 2, 3 around 1 half. On the other end, you have a large rotation, not maximal, but large in any case, with sine squared theta 1, 2 around 1 third. In the middle, you have a small rotation, maybe null, and we don't know anything about theta 1, 3. We only know that it must be small. The crucial problem is then to measure theta 1, 3. How can we measure theta 1, 3? And delta afterwards, the phase appears, which appears here. To measure theta 1, 3 and delta is a particular relevance, as we know, because in a full three neutrino scenario, a CP violating difference may arise between neutrino and antineutrino oscillation probabilities. You see here the difference which gives rise to a CP violating difference, but you need to have sine 2 theta 1, 3 non-zero, sine delta non-zero, and the oscillation phases neither too small nor too large. So hunting for theta 1, 3 is crucial in neutrino research in order to plan future CP violation searches. However, here can fix the upper bound on theta 1, 3. He comes from the Shaw experiment with a good approximation. This is the survival probability, and here you see that for given delta m square, we can extract from the PEE the sine squared theta 1, 3 and see that sine squared theta 1, 3 is less than a few percent. This gives rise to a feverish worldwide activity to run new reactor experiments with higher theta 1, 3 sensitivity. They need to use also a closed detector to reduce systematics. And this is the experiment known as Double Shaw, Dia Bay, and Reno. However, in the meantime, some weak hints or lower bounds have appeared and can be taken into account. A first weak hint comes from a three neutrino analysis of atmospheric neutrino data, including also long baseline accelerator experiment and Shaw, by considering the effect related to the subleading solar term. Another weak hint comes from an accurate comparison within a three neutrino approach of the solar snow-dominated and Kamlan data. Let me start with the first, which is an old but persisting hint for sine squared theta 1, 3 larger than zero, coming from our analysis of atmospheric long baseline and Shaw data. Here you see a projection on the planes of the three parameters of the two mixing angles and the mass difference. And due mainly to the subleading solar term effects, which help fitting atmospheric electron even data, in particular the subject data, we see that the best fit is around one sigma away from zero. The other point is, second weak hint, is the slight disagreement between solar data, which is not dominated, and the Camden data taken at theta 1,3 equal to 0. Here you see the figure taken from the official Camden site in the 2008, when the two best fits are compared in the usual plane in which we report the mass difference square and time square of theta 1,2. The disagreement, however, is reduced if we take sine square theta 1,3 larger than 0. This can be seen in this comparison, in which sine square theta 1,3 here is 0, as in the previous figure, and here sine square theta 1,3 is 0.03. The reason of this difference is due to a different correlation between theta 1,2 and theta 1,3 in the SNOW and the Camden datasets. The effects have been presented in the conference in Venice in the 2008 and have been seen independently also by Barantek and Gilmatz. We can plot the solar plus Camden hint for sine square theta 1,3 larger than 0 in the plane of the two mixing angle, where the different correlation of the two data sets are more evident. Here you see Camden in blue and solar data in red. And it is evident the anti-correlation between the two data sets. By combining them, we have some evidence, some hint, better, for sine square theta 1,3 larger than 0. This is the value it can be obtained by taking into account this correlation. Taking together the two hints, solar plus Camden, atmospheric plus Chow plus long baseline react, long baseline accelerator, provide a possible indication in favor of sine square theta 1,3 larger than 0 at the level of 1.6 sigma. This can be seen here. Here you see the figure you have seen before. Here the combination with also the atmospheric plus long baseline and Chow data. And here you have a determination of sine square theta 1,3 at the level of 1.6 sigma, published in 2008. It is important to stress that this is the first determination sine square theta 1,3 coming not from a specific experiment devoted to its measure, but from a careful global analysis of all the available data on neutrino oscillations. In the same year, we publish a global analysis of the mass mixing parameters in the 2008. And here you see for the first time the indication of sine square theta 1,3 included between the mass mixing parameters. This is 2008. What happens later? In the following years, the theta 1,3 hints seen before have been debated at length and have reached but not exceeded the statistical level of about 2 sigma. But new experimental results, now from long baseline accelerator experiments, come to rescue. In 2011, T2K and Minos found some electron event excess when running in appearance mode, nu mu going to nu e, and here you have the 2T2K excess of 2.5 sigma, and here the minus excess of 1.5 sigma. Both experiments favor sine square theta 1,3 larger than 0. Here you see the probability of transition, and you see to have a difference from 0 this term, you need theta 1,3 different from 0. So at this point, it makes sense to combine this with all the other oscillation data And in 2011, you have the, our global result from sine squared theta 1,3. Here you have two figures because we have distinguished the case of old reactor fluxes and new reactor fluxes. In any case, taking one of the two, you can distinguish in red solar plus Camland, in blue atmospheric plus Lombard line plus Shaw, and in black the combination of the two. Now, note that atmospheric plus Lombard line plus Shaw are now more significant than the solar plus Camland data. Moreover, there is an astonishing conspiracy of the two totally independent sets of data in indicating theta 1,3 larger than zero. This is the global evidence with the value we have obtained, and as a result, we have an evidence for sine squared theta 1,3 larger than zero at more than 3 sigma, 3 standard deviation, with small changes in the central value related to the new or old reactor fluxes assumed in the fit. 1 year later, we are now in the 2012, we have the experimental discovery of sine squared theta 1,3 larger than zero from the Shaw baseline reactor experiments. Double Shaw, Reno, Daya Bay. We can now compare our analysis versus the Shaw baseline reactor results. From the particle data group, we take the Shaw baseline result in 2012 with this value for sine squared theta 1,3. On the other hand, we can compare this result with our analysis. Not so bad, our analysis. Do you agree? Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Foley. If there are comments or questions? No? Let's move now to Professor Lisi for hearing his presentation.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So you just heard about what happened about 10 years ago. It's 20 years from the discovery of oscillations in 1998 with atmospheric neutrinos. And now let's move fast forward. So I will discuss the status of known and unknown 3 neutrino parameters as of today. Let me first say that I'm deeply honored to receive the Bruno Pontecorvo Prize together with Gianluigi Fogli for our contribution to the global analysis of neutrino oscillation data. And our journey in neutrino physics started exactly 25 years ago at the end of my PhD. I did my PhD on a different subject, electroweak precision data analysis within the standard model and beyond at one loop. At the time, we were in competition with our chairman, Olszewski, in the Z-Fitter and Electroweak working group, as well as with Levo Kuhn and collaborators doing this kind of analysis. But the absence of hints for new physics at LEP was a bit worrying for me. So we tried to explore something that could be more fruitful in terms of new physics. So we started to explore neutrinos. And retrospectively, this was a really good move, I have to say. So our first contribution was in the proceedings of neutrino telescopes in Venice in 1993, and we studied the effects of SUSY flavor change in neutral current. That was on solar neutrino oscillations. That was a time where supersymmetry was very fashionable. But during the years, we have attracted a number of outstanding students that have become now accomplished researchers or professionals and as it was mentioned, they formed the so-called neutrino bary group that was also mentioned in the jury extended motivation. The Pontecorvo Prize is awarded to a group of authors, including Gianluigi Foglia and myself. So this is the neutrino bary group. Besides us, you can see Daniele Montanino, Gaetano Scioscia, Antonio Marrone, Antonio Palazzo, Anna Maria Rotunno, Alessandro Mirizzi, Irene Tamborra e Francesco Capozzi. So, it's stuck, okay? Today's award is a great honor for the whole group. I have to say that in the 90s, the bary research activity in the theory and phenomenology of neutrinos was built from scratch, but it benefited from an existing experimental activity. And actually, I have problems in going forward. Okay. The experimental groups had invited Bruno Pontecorvo in Bari, where he gave a public colloquium in March 1990. This is something I discovered very recently. He talked about his experience as one of the Via Panisperna boys, the famous group led by Enrico Fermi in Rome. But the reason why... for some reason this is stuck. I don't know what's the problem here. Okay. I missed that unique event, being committed during my military service. So I'm really glad to ideally meet Bruno Pontecorvo here. And this is an article on the local Gazette of Southern Italy. So let's go to the parameters of the three neutrino mixing paradigm. As you know, quarks are mixed through the Kabibo-Kobayashi-Maskawa mixing matrix, and the analogous for neutrinos deservedly is named after Pontecorvo as well as Makina Kagawa Sakata, and the mixing matrix can be expanded in terms of three rotations. Two of them are real, one can be complex and including a CP violating Dirac phase, and there may also be extra phases if neutrinos are Majorana, but these are not tested by oscillations. Another ingredient of the paradigm is the neutrino mass spectrum that can be either quark-like, namely two light neutrinos and a relatively heavy one, or anti-quark-like, vice versa. This is called normal ordering, this is called inverted ordering, and the relevant parameters are the difference of the square masses because they enter in the dispersion relation of ultra-relativistic neutrinos, plus an interaction energy if they propagate in matter through the celebrated Mikhaev-Smirnov-Wolfenstein effect. Okay, so now we have a lot of neutrino oscillation experiments that probe different oscillations, nu alpha to nu beta, either in disappearance or in appearance mode. In each of these plots, a straight line would be an oscillation. So any deviation from the straight line is a signal of oscillation, and we have it nu e to nu e in Kamland long baseline reactor oscillation, solar neutrinos. You can see clearly the oscillation pattern, as well as the adiabatic transition in solar neutrinos. Nu mu to nu mu in atmospheric neutrino and long baseline accelerators. You can see the first dip of oscillations here with a different frequency. And also nu e to nu e disappearance mode in short baseline reactors, and nu mu to nu e appearance in long baseline accelerators, as well as nu mu to nu tau appearance in Opera and Supercamiocande. So this is just an example of the many data that now we have on neutrino oscillations, and that these different data are sensitive to different couples or triplets of neutrino oscillation parameters that you can see here. So for instance, solar and Kamblan neutrinos are more sensitive to the small delta m square and theta 1,2, while nu mu disappearance in atmospheric and long baseline experiment is more sensitive to the big delta m square and theta 2,3, and so on and so forth. There are also subleading sensitivities to CP violation and to the difference between normal ordering and inverted ordering, and now this is coming essentially via the nu mu to nu e appearance channel in long baseline accelerator and atmospheric experiments. Now, even without making a complicated analysis, but just some back of the envelope calculation, it is possible to get a broad brush picture of these parameters. So five of them are knowns. For instance, with one digit, these are the values of the Tuma square difference and the three mixing angles. And this is, if you want, a broad brush picture of the Volga River and its shore. But we have also five unknowns: delta, the Dirac's epivariating phase, the ordering of neutrinos, either normal or inverted, the octant of theta to 3, which tells us if there is more nu mu than nu tau mixed with the third state nu 3. We don't know the zero on this mass scale, so the absolute mass scale is still unknown, and we don't know the Dirac-Majorana nature of neutrinos. But if we want to go from a broad brush picture to a high resolution and larger picture, then we have to make a global analysis of all the oscillating data. And the analysis, for methodological reasons, can be split in the following way, including increasingly rich oscillation data sets. So first is appropriate to combine long baseline accelerator data, solar and Kamblan neutrinos. Then one adds short baseline reactor data, and in the end, atmospheric neutrinos. I adopt a chi-square metric in the following. Confidence levels are just the square root of delta chi-square, so 1, 2, and 3 sigma, and so on and so forth. And the details are given in this paper. Now, long baseline accelerators, just to tell something, are giving important information now because the appearance probability, nu mu to nu e, contains a complicated dependence on all the oscillation parameters. And it is impossible to disentangle all these pieces just from one measurement, but the short baseline reactor and atmospheric neutrino searches help to disentangle, at least in part, the relevant physics and to test theta 1,3 CP violation, normal ordering versus inverted ordering. The take-home message is the following. The relevant new results in the last couple of years are hints in favor of CP violation in neutrinos and in favor of normal ordering. So you heard about the old hints about theta 1,3. Now we have two new ones. So in the following figure, we will see the number of sigma as a function of the parameter value for normal ordering or inverted ordering. But it turns out, these curves would be linear and symmetric for perfect Gaussian errors, but you will see that there are also non-Gaussianities. But if you take into account that inverted ordering is always disfavored now with respect to normal ordering, this curve will be shifted and somewhat modified upwards. So let's have a look at what the current data are telling us. So if we combine only long baseline accelerator, solar and Kamblan data, so without any reactor data, without any atmospheric neutrino data, these are the number of sigmas as a function of the two squared mass differences and the three mixing angles and the CP violating phase delta. So you can see that the best fit is always reached in the blue curves from normal ordering, while inverted ordering, it moves by one sigma upwards. And also there are details that one could disguise, like for instance, theta 2,3 is close to being maximal, 45 degrees, but one cannot really tell the octant at one sigma. And you can also see a very interesting information that the phase delta is favored around 3 pi over 2, which means sine delta close to minus 1, which is maximal CP violation. So there is a preference for maximal CP violation in the current data. Now, if we add the short baseline reactors, and if I flip-flop these two, you can see that there is an improvement, especially in theta 1,3, but also the normal, the inverted hierarchy curves move upwards, so they are more disfavored. Inverted ordering is disfavored at around the 2 sigma level, while the indication for delta are corroborated. And if we add in the end atmospheric neutrinos, this trend is fully confirmed. So there is an improvement on all the parameters with one sigma bounce at the level of a few percent. CP violation sine delta close to minus 1 is favored, while the case of no CP violation is disfavored at the 2 sigma level. And there are meaningful bounds at 3 sigma level. And inverted ordering is disfavored at the level of 3 sigma. So these are hints that are coming from current data, and there is potential for improvement in the next few years. If you want to go into more details in the question time, I'll be glad to do it, but let me skip this and just give a summary. So the precision with which we are measuring the oscillation parameters now is at a level of a few percent. One delta M square is even measured at the level of 1.4%. And if you believe these hints about the CP violating phase, then you can say that it is already constrained at order 10%. So there has been a dramatic progress in the last two decades on the Pontecorvo, Machina, Kagawa, Sakata, three-neutrino paradigm, although there is still a long way to go to reach CKM level accuracy and redundance. And certainly the hints for nearly maximal CP violation normal ordering will be at center stage in the next years. Let me briefly say something also on absolute masses. There are three ways to access absolute masses, through beta decay, the famous Fermi idea of looking at the endpoint of the beta spectrum, neutrinoless double beta decay if neutrinos are Majorana, and cosmology, because cosmological data probe the total gravitational charge of neutrinos, namely the sum of neutrino masses. They probe different combinations of the masses, and they give additional handles on distinguishing normal and inverted ordering. Even if we don't know anything about these observables, but just plot one versus the other, m beta versus the sum of neutrino masses, m beta beta versus sigma, m beta beta versus m beta, oscillation data tell us that these parameters must lie within these narrow bands for normal ordering and inverted ordering. But actually, we have data on these parameters, only upper bounds at the moment. So we can put upper bounds on beta decay, on neutrinoless double beta decay, and cosmology. And already cosmology is cutting a large part of the inverted ordering phase space. So it's consistent with the current indication in favor of normal ordering. But major improvements are expected in the next decade. So these upper bounds are expected to go down by an order of magnitude, like this. And so maybe in the next 10 years, we will have some positive evidence about neutrino mass from cosmology, and hopefully from neutrinoless double beta decay, and why not from Catherine about beta decay. So let me conclude by saying that we are really in the middle of a transition from unknown to known properties of neutrinos. And in particular, we have some hints about neutrino CP violation the mass ordering. But the mass and the nature of the neutrinos will be at the focus of the worldwide research, both experimental and theoretical. And certainly, global analysis of oscillation data plus non-oscillation data will continue to play a role in deepening our understanding of this paradigm for three neutrinos, or maybe discover something beyond it, maybe a fourth neutrino, who knows. So certainly neutrinos will not cease to amaze us. And let me thank you for your attention.
I'd like to congratulate both laureates and thank them for the very relevant presentations.
Thank you.
May I ask science policy question. So neutrino, artificial neutrino beams have gone from Europe 10 years ago when CNGS was put down. So, and now, so the neutrino physicists should go either to States or to Japan to make experiments. Could you comment on that? And that situation will not change in the next 20 years at least, with just one exception, that European spallation source idea.
Well, this is a matter of fact, but there is an interesting activity going on the European spallation source, so there is a valid group that is trying to explore this possibility to bring again a neutrino beam in Europe. Then I don't know if the funding and the manpower will be enough to make this idea true. For the moment, people are working on ideas that have at least preliminary funding, like you said, in the US, DUNE and all the associated physics program, and in Japan, now T2K and also Hyper-Kamiokande, that very recently got I would not say an approval, but they say seminal funding, which is, however, in Japanese style prose, it's almost sure funding. So certainly people are concentrating on these two projects, but I would not exclude that maybe the European Spallation Source can be a point of attraction of European physicists. But this is difficult for me to judge. I hope, I mean, that in any case, European neutrino physicists, both in experiments and in theory, can give their contribution to world physics. Then I don't know exactly where.
Next question from Michel Spiro.
Thank you very much for this very clear presentation and for the one of Gianluigi Fogli. Is it possible for you to give us a short status of where we are with the sterile neutrinos?
I would say, okay, the status of sterile neutrinos is the following. There are still indications in favor of sterile neutrinos, mainly coming from LSND and the follow-up experiment Mini-Boon, that have not been disproven so far experimentally, because it's very difficult to make these appearance experiments, but that are in big tension with a lot of other disappearance experiments where really, one cannot find a coherent picture pointing towards sterile neutrinos at the electron volt scale. If you put everything together, more or less, you can get some best fit point, which is also consistent with recent results by Dance at reactors and also by the NEOS experiment in Korea. But we really need to sort out this with decisive experiments with higher statistical sensitivity and also in appearance mode. So I think unless, and there are many actually going on, so I'm pretty sure that in a few years we will get some important results. Maybe the decisive ones will come from appearance experiments that can be done, for instance, at Fermilab. Also, there is an experiment in Japan trying to do an appearance experiment. In the end, this will be sorted out. It's a difficult situation because the coherent picture is not emerging. But of course, the discovery of a new neutrino species, a sterile one, would be a major discovery. So this is why people are excited. But the situation is not as clear as for three neutrinos as I have shown so far. But the activity is going on, so we'll certainly learn more in the next few years.
I don't see other questions. I'm glad that the high quality of the presentation triggered a vivid debate. Thank you once more. Congratulations. Now comes a traditional point of our scientific council, and I want to give the floor to our general director, Professor Matveev, for the presentation of diploma of the winners of the GNR annual prize. First, Zhelepov Prize, okay. So first is the Zhelepov Prize.
Dear colleagues, we have very big pleasure to present you jury recommendation of awards for Zhelepov Prize in this year. Venedikt Petrovich Zhilepov Prize is awarded for outstanding achievements in the field of experimental and theoretical research aimed at addressing applied problem with the use of nuclear physics problem. Here you can see the members of jury, Viktor Anatolyevich is chairman. I have pleasure to present this. It was resolved, we have decided to award this prize to Vladimir Ivanovich Komarov for his pioneering work for the construction of the first channel of proton therapy at the general positron. Recently was his seminar at our laboratory, and we figure out that it's a really outstanding person who made very huge contribution. This picture shows you some very first publication on the subject, which was made in our institution on this on the topic, and the main idea to start to very urgently start this research was connected with the health of very famous Russian scientist Isaac Yakovlevich Pomeranchuk, and try to solve his problem, oncological problem. This was decided to very urgently, very quickly start to do. You see that Komarov and Savchenko was the first two people who made this strong contribution. Oleg Vasilyevich Savchenko already not with us, but he already managed to got this prize, one of the first. So Viktor Ivanovich is the second one. We kindly ask to support this, to approve this recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Валерий Васильевич,
подойди. No, he is not here. He is on the way.
The applause is, I think, is the manifestation of the approval of this recommendation.
Yes, please. So.
Thank you for
thank you very much.
Did you go to this? Yeah?
Yes.
So, as I said before, the next point is the traditional presentation of diplomas to the winners of GNR annual prizes for best papers in the field of scientific research, instruments and methods, and applied research. And Professor Matveyev, and assisted by the Scientific Secretary of the Council, Alexander Sorin, will present these diplomas. Please.
Let me announce the laureates, but please do not leave hall the laureates, because a group photograph will be taken after all. And please. Spin dynamics in arbitrary gravitational and electromagnetic fields. Obuchov.
Юрий Николаевич.
And Силенко. А где? Все три есть?
Нет. Вот вы работу читаете и.
The first prize strong electro for the theoretical physics research strong electron correlations in underdoped high temperature superconductors to Илье Дмитриевичу Иванцову. And Евгению Андреевичу Кочетову. General prizes for experimental physics research. First prize for the work delayed neutron emission of exotic nuclei. To Dmitry Alexandrovich Testov.
Юрий Эраштович Пеняшкевич. Евгений Александрович Соколов. Сокол. Зарезано. Елена Александровна Кузнецова. Владимир Иванович Смирнов. Михаил Петрович Иванов. Алексей Павлович Северюхин. Дальше давайте.
Так, следующая, вторая.
Second prize in the field of experimental physics research for the paper for the work search for 2p decay of the first excited states of niobium to Andrei Anatolievich Besbach. Сергей Анатольевич Крупко. Юлия Львовна Парфенова.
Юлия, прошу вас. Поздравляю вас.
Сергей Иванович Сидорчук. Роман Станиславович Слепнев. Гурген Микольтитович Терокопьян. Андрей Сергеевич Фомичев. Резно. Павел Германович Шаров. Это кто?
Методика.
In the field of physics, instruments and methods, first prize for the work, development and construction of gas field detectors based on new type of straw tubes for operation vacuum into a track spectrometer of the NA62 experimental setup. Леонид Николаевич Глонти. Владимир Дмитриевич Кикилидзе. Дмитрий Турыскалыевич Мадигожин. Юрий Константинович Потребельников. Вячеслав Александрович Самсонов. Сергей Николаевич Шкаровский. Поздравляю, the second prize for the work Structure and Deterministic Mass Surface and Multiphase Fractals, Theory and Methods of Analyzing the Intensity of Small Angle Scattering, to Alexander Ivanovich Kuklin. Eugene Mircea Anitas. First prize in the applied physics research for the work development and construction of the permanent magnet ECR ion source. Decris PM for the DC-280 cyclotron, to Vladimir Vasilievich Bekhterev. Сергей Леопольдович Богомолов. Андрей Евгеньевич Бондарченко. Константин Игоревич Кузьменков. Александр Николаевич Лебедев. Владимир Николаевич Логинов. Владимир Евгеньевич Миронов. Николай Юрьевич Язвицкий. First prize in the field of applied research for the work construction of a facility for assembling and testing superconducting magnets, investigations of the characteristics of the magnets, to Николай Николаевич Агапов. Владимир Владимирович Борисов. Артем Рафаилович Галимов. Алексей Михайлович Донагину. Виктор Николаевич Карпинский. Владимир Дмитриевич Кикилидзе.
Не ожидал.
Сергей Александрович Костромин. Дмитрий Николаевич Никифоров. Гамлет Георгиевич Хаджибагиян.
Прикладная, это Гиннес.
Где?
Прикладная, вот здесь, ну, один Куклин будет.
Это encourages.
Да, это почти Гиннес.
encourages prizes is rewarded for the work study of ultra-local neutron diffraction by moving grating to German Vyacheslavich Kuklin. Next, encourages prize for the work determination of the decay time of scintillators, investigation of space correlations of nuclear radiation by the autocorrelation method to Vladimir Alexandrovich Morozov. And Viktor Borisovich Zlokazov. The third encourages prize for the work investigation of nonlinear dynamics of waves in the terahertz frequency range in the condensed media and living systems to Alexander Nikolaevich Bugay. And last encourages prize for the work Monte Carlo simulations of neutron spectrometers and neutron scattering experiments to Alexander Vladislavovich Belushkin. And Viktor Ivanovich Bondarchuk. Now all laureates are invited at the stage to make group photo.
Let's congratulate all winners. And we can have a better.
Is invited at the reception in the next room. The members of the Scientific Council are kindly asked to come back at 1 o'clock for the general discussion. Enjoy the lunch.